Authorship and Date of the Synoptic Gospels by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. This talk sketches the historical evidence regarding the author and date of writing of each of the three so-called Synoptic Gospels, namely Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Also included is a brief sketch of some of the distinctive features of each. So let's begin with the authorship, and we're going to look at the authorship of Matthew first of all. We're going to look at internal evidence first and external evidence next. Let's look then, internal evidence regarding the authorship of Matthew. Except for the title, the text of Matthew is anonymous, no remarks inside the text telling who wrote it. The title, in its simplest form, is Euangelion Kata Mattaion, Gospel according to Matthew. there are no titles on the Matthew manuscripts give any other author, and there are no Matthew manuscripts with the place where the title would be that have no title. We don't know if the title was put on the gospel by the original author or not. We don't have the autograph. We can feel pretty confident of that. It is interesting that only this gospel lists Matthew as a tax collector, which, although may have been a money-making proposition for many people, was rather disastrous socially and not something I think people would brag about outside tax collector and government circles. What about the external evidence for the authorship of Matthew? Well, a number of the early church fathers testified to this gospel as being written by Matthew. Papias, who flourished about 130 AD, Irenaeus, about 180 AD, Pantinus, about 180 AD, Clement of Alexandria, about 200 AD, and Origen, about 240 AD. None of these suggest another author, and none of them deny Matthew as author. Here's what these particular writers have to say. Papias, writing about 130, a person who we have reason to believe actually studied under the Apostle John, he says, "Then Matthew wrote the oracles in the Hebrew dialect, but everyone interpreted them as he was able." The writings of Papias do not survive to us here at the present, as far as we know. This particular quotation is cited by Eusebius, flourishing about 325, in his Church History, Book 3, Chapter 39, Section 16. As I say, Papias' original is not extant, a work called The Exposition of the Oracles of the Lord, but it did still survive into the Middle Ages, and we have scattered quotations from it here and there by a number of the Church Fathers. Looking over that quotation again, "Then Matthew wrote the oracles in the Hebrew dialect, but everyone interpreted them as he was able," certain questions arise from this remark. What, first of all, is meant by the term oracles? The term is used sometimes for revelation from God, though it perhaps has somewhat a flavor of spoken material. Of course, all that Jesus said apparently was spoken by him. We don't have any evidence that Jesus wrote any materials. What is meant by Hebrew dialect? Some have suggested that just means a Hebrew way of speaking English. The term is broad enough. It can also mean the Hebrew language as well. George Howard, at the University of Georgia, I believe, has recently discovered a Hebrew Matthew preserved in an anti-Christian Jewish polemic from the Middle Ages. Howard argues from certain features of the text, particularly the occurrence of word plays in the Hebrew, that this work does not look like it was made by anti-Christian authors, even though it is only preserved to us in an anti-Christian author. And Howard suggests that we are looking in this text from the Middle Ages at a text that was very early. That's why he calls it a primitive Hebrew text, but that it has been transmitted, if you like, in hostile hands, and so may not be a really great representation of the text. He also points out it does not look like it's a translation from the Greek, and suggests that we are in fact here in contact with the original Hebrew of Matthew that predates the Greek text that we have. Well, Irenaeus next, flourishing about 180. Irenaeus studied under Papias, whom we just met under Polycarp, and he has this to say. Now, Matthew published also a book of the gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church. This is preserved for us in Greek in Eusebius' church history, but we have a Latin translation of it that has survived in Irenaeus' own work Against Heresies. So the whole of Against Heresies comes down to us in Latin, and scattered quotations from it in Greek in Eusebius as well. So this particular quote is out of Against Heresies, Book 3, Chapter 1, Section 2. Notice that Irenaeus calls Matthew's work a gospel, and he puts it in the Hebrew dialect as well, and he gives a date. He says that Matthew published this gospel while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church. Well, we don't know for sure when Peter first arrived in Rome, and there are some disagreements on that, but Paul was in Rome in the early 60s, probably from about 60 to about 63, somewhere in that time range. So apparently Irenaeus is intending something in that range. Pantinus, writing about the same time, we have quoted indirectly in Eusebius' church history as follows. Pantinus also was one of them and is said to have gone to India, where the story goes that he found the gospel according to Matthew, which had preceded his arrival, among certain people there who had learned of Christ, that Bartholomew, one of the apostles, had preached to them, and that he had left the writing of Matthew in Hebrews' letters, which was also preserved to the time indicated, that is, to the time that Pantinus was there. That's found in Eusebius' Church History, Book 5, Chapter 10, Section 3. Well, Pantinus was a Christian from Alexandria who was head of the catechetical school there. Notice that Eusebius gives this as indirect information. Is said to have gone to India, where the story goes, etc. Okay. The text, then, the Hebrew text of Matthew is said to have been preserved in India still in the late 2nd century. Next, Clement of Alexandria, around 200, and again a secondhand remark by Eusebius, though here a citation from a work by Clement called Outlines. Again, in the same books, as Outlines, Clement gives a tradition of the early presbyters concerning the origin of the Gospels in the following manner. He said that those Gospels which contain the genealogies were written first, but that the Gospel according to Mark had this occasion. So we can see here that Clement of Alexandria puts Matthew and Luke earlier than Mark. Next we come to Origen, writing about 240. Origen is here writing in his commentary on Matthew, and we have preserved for us in Eusebius' church history. In the first of the books on the gospel according to Matthew, observing the ecclesiastical canon, he, Origen, this is Eusebius talking, testifies that he knows only four gospels, writing somewhat as follows. As he has learned by tradition concerning the four Gospels, which alone are undisputed in the Church of God under heaven, that first there was written the Gospel according to Matthew, the one-time publican, but afterwards an apostle of Jesus Christ, who published it in the Hebrew language for those from Judaism who believed. So Origen uses the even more explicit term language rather than dialect regarding the what the Gospel of Matthew was in. Mentions that Matthew was a tax collector, publican. It was one of the Latin terms for a tax collector, a particular class of them. And this is one of the four Gospels, and that it was first that was written, according to the information that Origen has. If we try to summarize this material on the authorship of Matthew, that is the first Gospel, that Matthew wrote the Gospel ascribed to him is a unanimous opinion of tradition and of the titles on extant manuscripts. That Matthew's Gospel was the first written is also given several times in the tradition. That Matthew's Gospel was written in Hebrew could possibly have been Aramaic. The term Hebraios could include Aramaic, is a regular feature of the tradition. And on top of that, you have this primitive Hebrew Gospel that George Howard has found as well. So that on the authorship of Matthew. We turn next then to the authorship of Mark. And again, we're going to look at internal evidence and external evidence. So what do we have on internal evidence regarding Mark? Like Matthew, Mark is anonymous in its text, except for its title. Evangelion Kata Markon is the simplest version of that that exists. The others tend to be Holy Gospel according to, or Gospel according to Saint, etc., that sort of thing. Some have suggested that the style of Mark's Gospel fits Peter's personality. That is, the Gospel, like Peter, tends to be impressionable rather than reflective, tends to be emotional rather than logical, gives many vivid details, and these features suggest some of the features of Peter himself, who jumps in rather quickly into things and such. So the reason this has been suggested is that there's a tradition that Mark is in fact preserving Peter's testimony in this regard. The outline of Mark's Gospel also fits Peter's talk at Cornelius' house. That is, it starts with the work of John the Baptist rather than going back and dealing with the genealogies as the other two synoptic Gospels do, or going back to a creation as John's Gospel does. The narrative standpoint is consistent with Peter's authorship. What do we mean by narrative standpoint? Well, the narrative standpoint is the way in which an author writes a book so that the reader will tend to look at it from the perspective of a particular person. So if you have read any of the Harry Potter stories recently, with only occasional exceptions, the author J.K. Rowling writes in such a way that the reader looks at the thing from the narrative perspective of Harry Potter. That is, we find out about what Harry Potter knows about, typically, not about what other people might know about except as they tell him. That's not done everywhere in that series that way, but that's rather common. Mark 14:51, about the young fellow at Jesus' arrest who loses his outer garments to escape from being arrested, makes best sense as a sketch of Mark himself, a little bit the way in the classic films of Alfred Hitchcock, the author, producer, whatever you call Alfred, would typically show up in a little vignette somewhere in the story without drawing any great attention to himself. So, here's the passage, Mark 14:51. A young man was following him wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him, but he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. Well, that for internal evidence. External evidence. A number of the early church fathers testified to this gospel as being written by Mark. Papias again. Justin Martyr, whom we've not heard of before, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, and Origen. Let's have a look at these. Papias. again, writing in his Exposition of the Oracles of the Lord, which, as we say, has not come down to us directly, but here's a quotation cited again in Eusebius Church History. And this the presbyter used to say. Mark, indeed, since he was interpreter of Peter, wrote accurately, but not in order, the things either said or done by the Lord, as much as he remembered. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterwards, as I've said, Peter, who fitted his discourses to the needs, presumably of his hearers, but not as if making a narrative of the Lord's sayings. Consequently, Mark, writing some things just as he remembered, erred in nothing, for he's careful of one thing, not to omit anything of the things he heard, or to falsify anything in them. Well, that's Papias. Papias is citing information from before him. This the presbyter used to say. The presbyter is most likely the author of 2nd and 3rd John. The same term, presbyteros, is in the sender location in both 2nd and 3rd John. The term is a rather technical one today, but can be translated elder, various other sorts of things, and even with elder might or might not mean a church office. Mark is pictured here in this quotation as the interpreter of Peter, and that might mean that in places where Peter did not know the language, Peter obviously knew something about Greek, but might not have known Latin, Mark may have interpreted for him, or it may mean nothing more than that Peter is the one who gives us, Mark is the one who gives us what Peter experienced, and therefore interprets Peter, if you like, to his readers. One might raise the question whether Papias is following rabbinic usage in this quotation here, where he gives a quotation and then a comment. So this, the presbyter used to say, and then we've got what perhaps is a quotation. Mark, indeed, since he was an interpreter, Peter wrote accurately, but not in order, the things either said or done by the Lord as much as he remembered. And then explanation, for he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterwards, as I've said, Peter, etc. it may well be that you're getting that kind of a technique going on here. Mishnah and Gemara, if you're into rabbinic terminology. Our next source on the authorship of Mark is the work of Justin Martyr, writing about 145 A.D. And here Justin says, it is written in his memoirs that he changed Peter's name, as well as the sons of Zebedee, Boanerges. Well, Justin, in this particular passage, has just mentioned Peter, and here he alludes to a passage that occurs only in Mark 3:16 and 17, the reference to the sons of Zebedee being called Boanerges. Justin's usage to refer to the Gospels is memoirs of the apostles, not memoirs of Jesus. So in his memoirs would presumably be Peter's memoirs. So Mark is pictured as memoirs of Peter, apparently, in Justin Martyr's comment. Moving on to Irenaeus, we had just quoted his material earlier where he said Matthew published the gospel, etc., while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome. But then he goes on, after their departure, Peter and Paul, from Rome, presumably, or whatever, the disciple and interpreter, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, also handed down to us in writing the things preached by Peter. That comes from Against Heresies 3:1-2. The ambiguity in this passage is the term departure. It's exodus in Greek, and it could be taken literally after Peter and Paul left Rome, or it could be taken figuratively for their death after they departed from this life, we might say. Both of those usages are pretty common in Greek terminology, in Greek speech, if you like, or Greek writing. So some ambiguity then on what Mark, what Irenaeus might be saying after, about when Mark wrote this this gospel. Did he write it after Peter's death or only after Peter departed from Rome? Move on to Clement of Alexandria, flourishing about 200. And Irenaeus is, again, quoting the commentary on Matthew, the gospel according to Mark, he had this occasion, he says, when Peter had preached the word publicly in Rome and had declared the gospel by the Spirit, those who were present, there were many, besought Mark, since he had followed him for a long time and remembered the things that had been spoken, to write out the things that had been said. And when he had done this, he gave the gospel to those who had asked him. When Peter learned of it later, he neither obstructed nor commended it. Well, the picture we get here apparently is that Peter is still alive after the gospel has been written. So Clement's tradition here favors after Peter and Paul had left Rome. So Peter hears about the gospel afterwards, okay, rather than Peter and Paul had left this life. Tertullian. Tertullian only has this brief comment in Against Marcion, chapter 4, section 2. So then of apostles, John and Matthew instill us with faith. Of apostolic men, Luke and Mark renew it. Is Tertullian giving an order of writing here? John and Matthew, first and second. Luke and Mark, third and fourth. Doubtful. Probably what he is doing is giving us, what shall we say, closeness to the events or something of that sort. John and Matthew, eyewitnesses. Luke and Mark, apostolic men, people who were close associates of the apostles. That's what we're really getting in this particular case. Origen, writing about 240, has just said that first Matthew was written, etc., and then goes on, the same passage, and that secondly there was written the gospel according to Mount Mark, who made it as Peter instructed him, whom also he acknowledges as son, in the Catholic epistle, in these words saying, the church in Babylon elect together with you, and Mark, my son, salute you. This is from Origen's commentary on Matthew. Well, if we try to put this material together on the authorship of the second gospel, that Mark wrote the gospel ascribed to him is a unanimous opinion of tradition and of the titles on extant manuscripts. So is the belief that he gives us Peter's preaching. These traditions are consistent with the nature of the gospel itself in a stronger and more obvious way than was the case with Matthew, where we really had nothing more than the that he was a tax collector, and that that rather unflattering description of him shows up only in the apostle list in Matthew. Some see a contradiction in the tradition between the date of Mark and Luke. We will come back and look at that by and by, but so far we've seen already that Clement of Alexandria has said the Gospels with the genealogies were written first, and so that'd be Matthew and Luke, and then Mark written afterwards, whereas it seems that Origen has the second gospel written to be the Gospel of Mark. Well, we need to think about that. We move on now to the authorship of Luke, and again looking at internal evidence and external evidence. Internal evidence, like the other two gospels we've spoken of, except for the title, the gospel text is anonymous, as the title Euangelion Kata Lukon. However, the prologue of the book of Acts links Acts to this gospel. So does the style of Acts and Luke link them together rather strongly. Internal evidence in Acts suggests that its author was a companion of Paul. So that's the internal evidence with regard to Luke, that we have the titles and no variety there, that this reference in the prologue of Acts as the former account, O Theophilus, I wrote of all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the day he was taken up, etc., indicates he had written a former account, and then the style of Luke and Acts is very, very close, etc. We don't have as many early references to Luke as we do to Matthew and Mark. If Papias said anything about Luke, it has not been preserved. We do have the Muratorian canon about 180, so about the same time as Irenaeus and Pantinus had been. We have Irenaeus, we have Clement, 200, we have Tertullian, about 200, and we have Origen, about 240. Let's have a look at each of these. Muratorian Canon is a work we estimate to be from about 180 AD. It's an early list of books in the New Testament, but it was apparently originally written in Greek, but we only have it in Latin. Our manuscript is fragmentary at the beginning and the end. So here's how it starts, but he was present among them, and so we put the third book of the Gospel is that according to Luke, Luke the physician, after the ascension of Christ, when Paul had taken him with him as a companion of his traveling, made an investigation, wrote in his own name, but neither did he see the Lord in the flesh, and thus as he was able to investigate, so also he begins to tell the story from the nativity of John. So the description is pretty clearly the Gospel Luke, which begins with the story of the birth of John, unlike Matthew or Mark or the Gospel of John, okay, the nativity of John the Baptist. he calls it the third book of the Gospel. He will go on to talk about the fourth book of the Gospel as John, so he's mentioned two books of the Gospel before this, and presumably they are Matthew and Mark. Irenaeus. Now Matthew published, etc., after their departure, Mark, etc., and then his next sentence. Luke also, the follower of Paul, put down in a book the gospel preached by that one. Afterwards, John, against heresies 3:1, 1 and 2. Here it appears that Irenaeus is giving a chronological order, though he doesn't quite say Luke was written third. He clearly has Matthew publishing his gospel, while Peter and Paul are in Rome preaching gospel. After their departure, Mark writes, so he's after Matthew. Then he has Luke also, so he doesn't actually use a chronological word. And then he does use a chronological word afterwards, John. So natural reading would be that he understood Luke as third, but he doesn't quite say so. Interesting, given the complications on that question elsewhere, huh? Clement, writing about 200, and here Eusebius is describing what Clement had to say in Clement's book Outlines. Again, in the same book, Clement gives a tradition of the early presbyters concerning the order of the Gospels in the following manner. He said that those Gospels which contained the genealogies were written first, but the Gospel according to Mark had this occasion, last of all John. So clearly Clement is saying that Matthew and Luke precede Mark, and John follows all of them. The chronological order seems to differ from Irenaeus's order. Here it's pretty specific in Clement, whereas Irenaeus's is not quite so definite. Tertullian has that remark which we read before, so then of apostles, John and Matthew instill us with faith, apostolic men, Luke and Mark renew it. For Luke's gospel, similarly, men are used to ascribe to Paul. So Mark's gospel is ascribed to Peter, Luke's gospel is ascribed to Paul. And then we move on to Origen. And thirdly, that according to Luke, the gospel praised by Paul, who made it for those from the Gentiles who believed. The remark about the gospel praised by Paul is probably an allusion to 2 Corinthians 8:18, though many readers have wondered whether that's really a reference to Luke's gospel. Summary and authorship of Luke. Oh, excuse me, let me look at 2 Corinthians 8:18 here in the New American Standard updated. We have sent along with him the brother whose fame in the gospel has spread through all the churches. NASU adds the two brackets there, the things of the gospel and has spread. But it's possible to read it as though it's speaking of the fame of Luke's gospel. Summary then on authorship of the Gospel of Luke. That Luke wrote the gospel ascribed to him is the unanimous opinion of tradition and of the titles on extant manuscripts. None of the remarks for Luke are quite as early as those of Papias for Matthew and Mark, but by AD 200, the remarks about Luke are from the whole Mediterranean area. These traditions are consistent with the internal evidence of vocabulary and connection with Acts. The gospel is frequently mentioned third, perhaps preserving a tradition on order of authorship, though there is some question on that particular matter. So, a quick tour then of the authorship of these three Gospels. It does not appear to me that there are sufficient reasons to doubt the traditional authors, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for these. You would have to, after all, claim that somehow the original names all got lost and all were uniformly replaced by these particular names. What about the dates? Well, the dates of the Synoptic Gospels, that is, when were they written? Date of Matthew, and again, we're going to look at internal and external evidence. Internal evidence is rather little help here. There are two remarks in Matthew that suggest it was not written immediately after the resurrection. It makes reference to this day. Liberals tend to date the Gospel of Matthew after AD 70. This is partly to post-date Mark, because a rather common view in New Testament scholarship is that Matthew depends upon the Gospel of Mark, what's called the two-document hypothesis, or another version of it, four-document hypothesis, but they basically amount to the same thing on this. We discussed that in our synoptic problem PowerPoint, so I'll let you take a look at that if you want more on that information. The other reason that liberals tend to date Matthew after AD 70 is partly to avoid fulfilled prophecy. Jesus, in the Olivet Discourse, makes some rather specific statements about when the city is surrounded, when Jerusalem is surrounded, then flee, etc. And in fact, we have evidence that the church did that, and basically the liberals suggest that the author of the Gospel of Matthew, not Matthew, stuck in this material after the fact, rather than this being an actual prophecy of Jesus. Well, internal evidence, then, not a whole lot. External evidence. Well, Matthew was obviously written before the earliest surviving manuscripts of it. And we have P64, P67, and P77 come from about 200 AD, so it's written before 200, but virtually nobody would have denied that any time in the last century or so. The apostolic father writing called Pseudo-Barnabas, written perhaps around 132, cites Matthew 22:14, so presumably Matthew is written before that date. The traditional authorship would place it before Matthew's death, and the impression we have from all of our tradition is that the last apostle to die was John, and that was probably around 100, so Matthew probably died well before 100 AD. We've got to figure these men are all grown during Jesus' ministry around 30 AD, so this is 70 years later, and so they would at least be in their 90s by this point, and John, who is sort of usually thought of as the youngest of them, only lives to 100, and he lives quite a long time. Irenaeus' tradition would put it in the range 61 to 68 after Paul arrives in Rome, 61, and before Nero commits suicide, 68, since the tradition is quite strong that Nero had both Peter and Paul put to death. Other traditions put Matthew first, so perhaps even earlier. Well, that's the external evidence on the date of Matthew. The upshot of this are various proposals, which range from AD 37 in the Old Scofield Reference Bible to AD 125, for instance, Robert Kraft at the University of Pennsylvania. My suggestion here is that Irenaeus published the Gospel, etc., while Peter and Paul were in Rome preaching Gospel, that Irenaeus is giving the date of the Greek edition and may have made a mistake here, because he certainly doesn't read like that way, that the original Hebrew was earlier than that, maybe late 40s or early 50s. This particular model here I propose is proposed to fit Matthew being the first Gospel and to fit Luke being written before AD 60, which we've got some good evidence for. We will take a look at that by and by here. So that's the range of proposals on the date of Matthew. Date of Mark. Again, internal evidence, external evidence. Internal evidence, nothing direct here. liberals try to post-date predictions, so they tend to put it late, but some of them even put it just before 70, and others after that. The solution to the synoptic problem will have a bearing here. If Matthew is really the first written gospel, then Mark may be later. If Mark is the first written gospel, as proponents of the two-document hypothesis put it, then that may put Mark back earlier. External evidence. Take a look at the various church fathers cited earlier. Clement has the Gospels with the genealogies written first, okay, and suggests that Peter heard about the Gospel of Mark after it had been written and responded, but did not either condemn or commend it. Irenaeus can be taken to be saying that Mark was written after Peter and Paul had died, but the Exodus term is vague enough that it might mean nothing more than after they had left Rome. If we count early manuscripts and count early citations, we see that Mark was considerably less popular than Matthew. And the question would be, does this have a bearing on the date question? Was Matthew's gospel on the scene and circulating before Mark, and so Mark never achieved quite the popularity it might have had if it had been written first? Well, there are various proposals also on Mark. The concordant understanding would be that Irenaeus and Clement are both picturing Mark being written while Peter's still alive, and so this would put Mark in the 60s before the death of Peter. A discordant interpretation would suggest that Clement of Alexandria is wrong, and Irenaeus means after the death of Peter and Paul, so after about AD 68. The conservative two-document view, that is those who are conservatives and believe that Mark wrote Mark, Matthew wrote Matthew, etc., but that believe that Mark was one of the sources that Matthew used, put Mark earlier than Matthew and Luke, and so put it in the late 50s. So we've got this range of proposals on the date of Mark. I would favor the concordant view myself. Date of Luke. Internal evidence and external evidence. Internal evidence. Clearly, the book of Acts, or the Acts of the Apostles, presupposes the existence of the Gospel of Luke, so the Gospel was written first of those two. Liberals feel Luke 21:20 reflects the Jewish War, so date Luke after AD 70, usually in the 80s. But, of course, this is not necessary if Jesus can predict the future. Evidence from Acts points to its being written before AD 64. We discuss that in our discussion of the date of Acts, which we discuss in our Acts and Pauline lecture notes. External evidence. Acts seems to date from the end of Paul's first Roman imprisonment, about AD 63. There's no reference to the Roman fire in the book of Acts, and that fire took place in the summer of 64. And there's no hint of Paul's death, and that took place no later than early 68. So, external evidence then would suggest that since Luke is somewhat earlier than Acts, then Luke must be no later than 63 or something of that sort. There is, of course, the problem of tradition on the relative date of Luke and Mark. Well, summary on Luke's date. I suggest that we should date Luke around 58 to 60 before Acts is written in 63 to 64. My suggestion is that Luke did his research for the gospel during the 2 years Paul was in prison at Caesarea. We know Luke was in that area of the world at that time, since he came back to Jerusalem with Paul at the end of Paul's third missionary journey, if you like. And so my suggestion is that Luke did his research for that, and the gospel began to circulate as they left Palestine. That Luke did his research for Acts in Rome during Paul's imprisonment there. It may be that Luke's own copy of the gospel was lost on a shipwreck as he and Paul went to Rome, and so it was a while before the gospel reached the western part, Rome and its vicinity, but it had already begun to circulate in the east, so that in parts of the empire, Luke circulated ahead of Mark, and in parts of the empire, Mark circulated ahead of Luke. Well, that is our tour then on dates of the Gospels. We suggest summary on the dates. Matthew, written in the 40s or 50s in Hebrew, with perhaps the Greek edition in the mid-60s when Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome. That Luke was written in 58 to 60 in Caesarea, and that Mark was written in the early to the mid-60s in Rome. We turn last to look at some of the characteristics of the Gospels, of the Synoptic Gospels again. We're going to look at characteristics of Matthew first. We're going to look at author, audience, aim and structure, distinctive phrases, and some other material. Matthew the author. Matthew is mentioned by name 7 times in the New Testament, but these only involve 2 occasions. Matthew's conversion, and then his appearance in the various apostle lists. We learn of his conversion, that after his conversion he held a dinner for his friends to meet Jesus. In the apostle lists, he's only called tax collector in the Gospel of Matthew list. He's always in the second group of 4 apostles. If you look at the various apostle lists in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts, I believe it is, you'll find that the people who occur in the first 4 of any of these lists always occur in the first 4 of those lists, though not necessarily all in the same order. Those who occur in the second 4 always occur in that 4, and those that occur in the third group of 4 always occur there. Not all the gospel lists have Judas Iscariot, since he's left out by the time he's committed suicide. So Matthew is always in the second group of 4 apostles. Matthew's audience. Well, we find in the Gospel of Matthew an emphasis on Jesus as Messiah, and this implies, I think, that the original audience were Jews, that Gentiles would not, independent of some strong contact and influence with Jews, would not have even known who the Messiah is. And in fact, we find out very quickly in the early references to Jesus outside the biblical material that Christ is often understood as one of Jesus' names rather than the title Messiah, Anointed One, which is what it obviously means in a Jewish background. Matthew's gospel tends to assume his readers know Jewish practices. So in Matthew 15:2 speaks of the tradition of the elders. In Matthew 23:5 talks about broadening the phylacteries, that even the NASB, which is a very literal translation, feels necessary to add a word or two to explain that for modern readers. And a reference in Matthew 23:27 of the Pharisees being like whitewashed tombs. So those would all require some knowledge of Jewish practices to get the actual nuance of what Matthew is doing there. The aim and structure of Matthew, well, there's no direct statement about the aim of Matthew's gospel. If you work through the content, that suggests that Matthew's purpose is to show Jesus as the Messiah, fulfilling Old Testament prophecies. Structure, we do have 2 narrative transition passages, which seem to divide up Jesus' ministry then into 3 pieces, and 5 discourses with closing transitions back into the narrative passages. Again, we have a transition passage between the materials about Jesus' birth and his temptation in the wilderness, and then a transition passage into the beginning of his Galilean ministry, and then another transition passage from what we might think of as the public ministry into his private ministry with the disciples. So that's the two narrative transition passages. Distinctive phrases. A very distinctive phrase in Matthew is the phrase, translated in English, that it might be fulfilled. It reminds us again of the emphasis on fulfillment of messianic prophecies, but not just what we think of as messianic prophecies, but also the fulfillment of Old Testament typologies, that is, certain objects or such are symbols of some coming reality. The other distinctive phrase is kingdom of heaven. The phrase is synonymous with kingdom of God, and Matthew a couple times uses both phrases together in some synonymous way. But the term heaven is one of the common rabbinic substitutions for God, and again perhaps suggests a audience of pious Jews is perhaps intended here, who might be offended by too much use of the term God. So where Mark and Luke use the term kingdom of God, Matthew normally uses the term kingdom of heaven, though once or twice I say he uses both of them together. Other unique materials in Matthew, well, references to Jewish customs, we've alluded to a little bit of that. Both he and Luke have birth materials, but certain birth materials are peculiar to Matthew, narrative of the wise men visiting and Herod attempting to kill Jesus and the flight to Egypt. And if we look at the birth materials carefully in Matthew, we see that they're written from Joseph's perspective. How did Joseph react to Mary's pregnancy? Vision, the dream that comes to Joseph to get him to accept Mary as his wife, the dream that comes to Joseph to get him to flee to Egypt, the dream that comes to Joseph getting him to come back from Egypt, etc. This in contrast with Luke, which has Mary's perspective. Huh? There are some church passages which are a little surprising in view of the fact that the Gospel of Matthew is what we might think of as the most Jewish of the Gospels. But the passage on you are Peter and upon this rock I'll build my church in Matthew 16, that's in Matthew, okay? And the passage on church discipline in Matthew 18 is in Matthew as well. That should remind us that the dispensational distinction between the Jews, Israel, and the church has been overdone. There's certainly some distinction, no question about that, but it's been overdone because the word ecclesia, church, was not invented for New Testament usage. It was already the term in use for a couple hundred years before the coming of Jesus as a translation for the Hebrew kahal, congregation. So it was the term that was used in the Old Testament translated into Greek to represent the people of God when they assembled together. Another unique material to Matthew is the Great Commission in Matthew 28, particularly with its ending, baptizing in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. All of the Gospels actually have some kind of a Great Commission, but they do not all have this particular incident. Characteristics of Mark. Well, we're going to think again of the author, the audience, the aim, and characteristics. Mark, the author, is actually mentioned much more frequently than Matthew, 10 or 11 times in the New Testament. They allow us to give a little shot at tracing Mark's life. We're told in Colossians 4:10 that he's a cousin of Barnabas. In Acts 12, that he lived with his mother in Jerusalem. He may have been present at Jesus' arrest, the speculation regarding who that is spoken of in Mark 14, 51, and 52. And in Acts 13, we're told he's an associate of Paul and Barnabas on Paul and Barnabas' first missionary journey. And as a result, he bails out in the middle of that, and Paul won't take him on his second journey, so he instead goes with Barnabas on a journey instead. Further tracing his life, Mark shows up again about 10 years later. In Colossians 4:10, he's being sent on a mission by Paul. And in Philemon 24, he is again a fellow worker with Paul. So apparently
his activities over those 10-year period allowed Paul to see that he had overcome the problems that had led to the trouble in the first place. We see a little bit Mark still later near Ephesus in 2 Timothy 4:11, where Paul says that Mark is useful to him and that he's to come to where Paul is along with Timothy. In 1 Peter 5:13, Peter calls Mark my son. although Peter was married, we have reference to that in the New Testament, it's probable that Mark is Peter's spiritual son rather than his physical son. So, Mark the author. What about Mark's audience in his gospel? Well, it's pretty clearly Gentile. A number of Aramaic phrases are given in the gospel, but they're all translated, and Jewish practices in the gospel are explained. It's possible that Mark's audience is Roman. of course, Romans are Gentiles as well, so you'd need some specific things. There are several Latinisms in Mark's gospel, but these are associated with Roman rule, centurion, name for a Roman officer, and frogoleo, the name for whipping, to flagellate, if you like. So both these terms are probably generally known and might therefore not indicate anything about Mark's audience. Mark's aim, like in Matthew, no direct statement in the gospel. Mark does not say that I've done this to preserve the teaching of Peter. The opening line, of course, may state the aim, but that's the general aim of all the Gospels. It starts out at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, excuse me, is what it says, the Messiah, the Son of God, etc. perhaps Mark is aimed or especially suited to Roman mentality. A number have suggested that it's rather practical, it's action-oriented, it's organized. And we suggested at least part of that had to do with what we thought perhaps was Peter's personality, but it may then also have to do with why, according to the tradition of Clement, the Romans were excited when they heard Peter's presentation and wanted Mark to write it up. Some of the characteristics of the Gospel of Mark is very vivid, lots of graphic and picturesque detail. It's detailed in that, although it's a short gospel, it covers fewer events with more detail than the other gospels typically do. It seems very breathless in its activity, with the regular use of euthus immediately as a connector between many of the events. And it uses Aramaic as well, and I discussed those in my Synoptic Gospels notes, but we said just a little bit about that earlier on as well. We move on to the characteristics of Luke, and again we want to look at author, audience, aim and method, and characteristics. Luke the author is mentioned by name only three times in the New Testament, so less than either Matthew or Mark. He's called a physician in Romans 4:14, what we'd call a medical doctor today, but a doctor was a later title given to those who practiced medicine. 2 Timothy 4:11 pictures him as a faithful companion of Paul. He appears to be a Gentile. When you look at the greetings at the end of Colossians 4:14, Luke is in the Gentile group. There's been a group of people mentioned, and Paul has said, these only are the ones of the circumcision who are with me, if you like, and then he lists these other two, of which Luke is one of them. And we see from a phenomenon in the book of Acts that he traveled with Paul. There are several places in the book of Acts where the narrative switches from they were doing this, etc., to we were doing this. And we believe these are places where Luke was present with Paul and the others on those travels, and has subtly indicated that by the switch in from third person to first person. We can think a little bit about Luke, the Greek physician. Terminology that he uses, some of the medical terminology that he uses, have a nice work by William K. Hobart, the medical language of St. Luke, etc. Terminology suggests that Luke was trained in the tradition of the Hippocratic school, a particular way of doing medicine that was important in the Greco-Roman world. This particular school was noted for diagnosis by observation and deduction, rather than diagnosis by divination or something of that sort, which was common enough in a number of the medical practices of antiquity. Also noted for careful case reports, and you almost get a little feeling that some of Luke's description of some of the medical miracles have a little bit of the case report flavor to them. The Hippocratic school was noted for simple treatments. They were not into hocus pocus and that sort of thing. And they were noted for high standards of hygiene. Some other suggestions about Luke that have been made. Some suggested that Luke's hometown was Syrian Antioch. And in fact, that suggestion goes back as early as Eusebius and Jerome, so 300s and early 400s. A modern suggestion is Philippi, which was a suggestion of Sir William Ramsay, one of the archaeological specialists in Asia Minor archaeology in the late 19th and early 20th century. He uses some speculation to come to that conclusion, but suggests that when Paul has this vision of the man calling him to come over to Macedonia, that the person he sees is Luke, that he had met Luke earlier that day or something of that sort. It is true that one of the wee passages starts there over in Troas and goes over to Philippi, and then a couple of years later the wee passage picks up again in Philippi and goes down to Jerusalem with Paul. But that need only mean that Luke was perhaps you might say delegated to help out with the ministry in Philippi, and that's where he stayed. Another suggestion that's been made about Luke is that Luke is the brother of Titus. This is a suggestion of Alexander Souter, based on the 2 Corinthians 8:18, who, in the context of talking about Titus, Paul mentions that his brother, whose fame in the gospel, etc., that has come along with Paul or something, and this is possible, but it's a rather speculative suggestion. Aim and method of Luke. This is given in Luke 1, 1 through 4. So although Matthew and Mark don't say anything about their aim and method to the extent that you can derive it from the contents, Luke explicitly says that his aim is to help Theophilus, the person whom he's writing this gospel, to know the reliability of the gospel history. And about his method, he tells us that he was aware of the status of his subject, that many had undertaken to write up accounts of this, just as was handed down by eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, that he himself had studied all related matters carefully, that he used materials from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, and that he wrote up an orderly sequential account. So we do have a little on aim and method of Luke. Let's then go on to say a word or two about Luke's characteristics. One is the emphases in his gospel. There's an emphasis we might call universalism. We do not mean by this the use of the term in theological circles in the last couple centuries, meaning everybody's going to get saved, but rather that the gospel is for all kinds of people, people from every tribe and tongue and nation, people from different social classes, men and women, rich and poor, all of that sort of thing. That is an emphasis of Luke's gospel. Also emphasized in Luke's gospel is Jesus' gracious attitude toward outcasts, towards sinners, harlots, tax collectors, lepers, and such. But give us his own prayer. More about Jesus' prayer and the content of them and that sort of thing in Luke than in the other Gospels. And a big emphasis, somewhat related to the universalism and outcast matter, of emphasis on social relationships. There are some unique materials in Luke's Gospel. One of these are the Semitic praise psalms, the praise psalm of John the Baptist's father, Zechariah, the praise psalm of Mary, the praise psalm of Simeon when he holds the baby Jesus in his arms in the temple, and perhaps a little short for a praise psalm, the praise of the angels announcing Jesus' birth to the shepherds, glory to God in the highest, etc. Certain parables, obviously, of the three Gospels that have what we normally call parables, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Mark doesn't really have many of them that aren't found in one of the other of the Gospels, but Matthew has some unique to him, and Luke has some unique to him. So there are some certain parables here. There's a class of parables in Luke that don't appear to be in Matthew and Mark, and that's what we might call paradigm or sample parables, in which instead of a earthly secular story of some sort that has a heavenly a meaning, a analogous or symbolic meaning, if you like the sower casting the seed, and the seed represents the message of the kingdom, and the soils represent the different perceptions. That would be what we'd call a standard story parable, or even allegorical parable. But Luke has some parables like the parable of the Good Samaritan, or the parable of the rich fool, or something of that sort, where already the story is a spiritual story, and it's a sample of who is my neighbor and how am I supposed to behave towards him, in regard to the Good Samaritan, or in regard to the rich fool, what your prosperity looks like in this life is no predictor of what you will look, what your situation will look like beyond the grave. Certain miracles in Luke are distinctive to it. And then also a section of narrative, the narrative of Jesus' activity in Perea, the region across the Jordan from the main part of Israel. And we have a number of accounts of things that took place over there. Well, that's the end of our quick tour here of the authorship and date and some of the characteristics of the Synoptic Gospels. But hopefully for you, this will be the beginning of a lifetime study of Jesus in the Gospels. I'm getting up there. I'm now 68, and I don't know how many more years I've got, but I have been very excited about getting to know something about Jesus as pictured in the Gospels, and that we need to concentrate in Protestant circles more about these narratives about Jesus than we typically do. Well, thank you, and that's where we will stop then.